3, 2, 1. Welcome back, everybody. Sometimes a little break like that is what we need to kind of get the blood flowing again and get that crink out of our neck. I understand that some people are actually getting neck massages to try to get through these sessions. If you prefer just to lie down and have somebody else take notes, just feel free. In this second session, though, presuming that you're now all bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, I want to talk a little bit about how we move from the time of Francis to our own time and some of the steps that are involved in doing that. Those of you who have heard me speak about this process before may recognize this. I repeat this in almost every talk that I give. So if you were at the Quinquennial in Chicago, I probably talked about it there. I've repeated it endlessly. But it's worth repeating because it's a way for us to avoid Franciscan fundamentalism. That is where we think we are going to recreate somehow Francis of Assisi. Let me tell you right now, we're not going to do that because he's dead. And God lover St. Clair is dead. We can actually see her body. It's kind of hard to see Francis's body. They're dead. They are not thinking anything about Franciscan life for us. They are not telling us anything about how we should live Franciscan life today because they don't have a clue about today. They don't live today. Neither of them has a cell phone. Neither of them speak English. We have to avoid the question, what would Francis do if he were here today? He would not do anything because dead people do not come to meetings. It's an impossible question. It's not even a very helpful question because it's imagining that somehow Francis would be able to sit down and figure out our world. He can't. Because he's dead. We don't ask dead people to mow our lawn. At least in my family, it tended to be like my brother and I that got asked. We don't ask dead people to write books for us. We write books about them. We don't ask dead people to run the church for us today. Like it or not, we use living people to do that. So as Franciscans, we have to avoid two temptations that I'm going to talk about. The first is the temptation that we want to go back and live in the world of Francis and Clair. Let me tell you right now, think twice before you wish for that. A world lit only by fire, Italy before tomatoes and pasta. Welcome to gruel. We cannot live in the 13th century, and we shouldn't pretend to. We are not the medieval and Renaissance fair of the church, you know, dressing up in funny medieval clothes or walking around, speaking medieval Latin, which I love. In the same way, Francis and Clair can't come into our century and live Franciscan life for us today because they're not around to live it. Look around, take a deep breath. If Franciscan life is going to survive in this country and in our church, it's going to be because of what you pass on to the next generation of Franciscans. Francis and Clair cannot do that for you because they are dead. Yes, thank you. We actually have to rely on each other to do that. We will never live the Franciscan experience that Francis and Claire had in the 13th century, as beautiful as that was, and as much as we can profit by learning a lot about it. That's an important thing to do. It's an inspiration for us. But we can't go back and live that experience. But on the other hand, Francis and Claire cannot live our experience of Franciscan life today. They simply don't have the tools to do that, like being alive. First condition, you must be alive to join this fraternity, and we should enforce that a little bit more strictly in some. You belong to those fraternities, do you? Okay. This has to be what is ours to do. And so, sorry, we can't pull Francis and Claire out of the sky to do it for us. We have to do the hard work of figuring it out and making a transition. The transition is from the 13th century values that we see in Francis and Claire to the 21st century society in which we live. Any mathematicians in the group? No, okay. I'm certainly not one. But at least I think I remember something called mathematical proportion. And it goes something like this in my very elementary knowledge. 4 is to 8 as 9 is to what? 18, how did you figure that out? Double. Well, I don't see double written there anyplace. But I don't see double. Where'd you get double? Oh, you had to figure out the relationship between the first two numbers. Gosh, you're smart enough to be secular Franciscans. Or as my dad used to say, God rest him, you didn't go to school just to eat your lunch. What we figured out here, if we get it correct, is that the relationship between the first number and the second number, where those two little dots are, there's a message in there that says double. And whatever number we put in the third place, that could be a 9 or a 10 or a 20, whatever it is, the answer at the end is going to change. So that number will always be different. But the thing that remains the same is where the little two dots are. If we do it correctly, it's always going to be double. The fourth number is going to be the double of the third number, just like the second number is double the first number. What we figured out is a relationship between them, and we can reproduce the relationship even if the numbers change. Let's do it in a different way. We call this cat is to gato as dog is to perro. How'd you know that? Chihuahua, yes. I wouldn't fit in the space there. You figured out that the relationship between cat and gato is translation from English into Spanish. Now, here's a trick question. What if I wrote gato with 2 T's? Then what would the answer be after dog? Cane. Why? Gato would be Italian. If it's 2 T's, it's Italian. 1 T, it's Spanish. Which means if we get it wrong the first time, and we think gatto with 1 T is Italian,
we're going to make mistakes forever on the other one because we didn't understand the relationship correctly. We got the most basic thing wrong. And then all the other answers get wrong after that. So you better spend some time making sure the first time you figure it out, you get the answer that's appropriate, that fits those words. This is going to connect back. Now, don't worry. This is going to connect back. There we go. Now we call this context or historical context. Francis and Claire are to 1200 as you and I are to. Ta-da! Welcome to the present. Francis and Claire are related to the church and the society, the world of the 1200s. That's where they live. That's where they do their living of the gospel. They do it in that historical context. We live the gospel, interpret Franciscan life the best that we can in our context in the 21st century, 2000 plus. Just as in the others, in the mathematical proportion or the translation, you can't take number or word number 3 and put it back into number 1. It's going to make everything go haywire. Same thing here. We can't put ourselves back into 1200. That just doesn't work. We can study Francis and Claire in 1200, but we can't live in 1200. That even with time travel, even in science fiction, we're not going to be able to do that quite yet. But in the same way, we can't drag Francis and Claire out of 1200 and make them come into the 2000s. We can't ask Claire what she thinks of television, even though she's the patron saint of it. We can't ask her about that. We can't put Francis here and say, if Francis were here, he would not want us to have a computer or a cell phone. Or Francis is not here. Francis can't have an opinion about cell phones or computers. He can have an opinion about parchment. He can have an opinion about quill pens. He can have an opinion about his context that can inspire us, inform us, give us a notion of the relationship, but then we have to figure out how that translates in our world because we're the experts in that. Francis is not. And I was just going to mention that Francis is dead. Thank you. Okay. Just wanted to keep that clear. And I love to visit his tomb. It's one of the, and I don't do it just because I take pilgrimages there. That's a genuine place that I like to go and pray. I mean, he's dead, but let me tell you, his spirit is very much alive, and I believe he intercedes for us. So I talk to him a lot, but he doesn't have opinions about computers, let me tell you. Let's look now at some examples of what this looks like. Is there a picture there? Beautiful picture here of Francis washing a leg. And the man who has the crutches there is being washed by Francis. And then on the right side, we kind of see him walking out of the frame. He's carrying the crutches over his shoulder, so he's been healed. And I'm not sure that this man was suffering from leprosy or what exactly it was, but I thought it was an appropriate image of how Francis cares for the sick in his day. And from the Testament, this is the quotation. When I was in sin, it was very bitter for me to see lepers. And the Lord led me among them and I did mercy with them. And afterward, what was bitter was turned into sweetness of soul and body.
When I was a young student in Italy, my first summer taking Italian language courses in Perugia, near Assisi, I went over to make my first visit to Assisi. Wow, this is a big deal. Took the bus over and had made arrangements to stay at San Damiano. I was staying at a Franciscan house in Perugia, and they called up and they said, the friars at San Damiano would be happy to have you. And there was an American who was living there as part of the community, had joined the friars in Italy, and had lived there for a long time. And I talked with him. He worked on early Franciscan texts. And I remember talking to him about this example. I said, you know, Francis speaks about the importance of serving people with leprosy or Hansen's disease. And how do you think we would interpret that today? He looked at me, he said, it's called leprosy. Franciscans can work with people who have leprosy. And in some places in the world, of course, we still do. He says it doesn't say cancer. It doesn't say polio. It doesn't say TB. It says leprosy. If you want to be a Franciscan and you want to work with sick people, you work with people who have leprosy. And it just, I mean, I was a young student, but that struck me as just kind of weird. Looking back on it now, that's what I would call Franciscan fundamentalism. In other words, we have to do just what Francis did. And although there are still many places in the world, including Vietnam, where the friars do great work with people with Hansen's disease, people also have lots of other diseases who get treated the way that lepers got treated in St. Francis's day. Can we make some translation into our context? So I look for a couple of examples. And this is a very close example. And this is actually Franciscan Missionaries of Mary, a great community of sisters, the largest Franciscan community of sisters, on Phantom Island, a leprosarium where they were working in Australia in 1945, bringing modern scientific equipment. They've got microscopes there to look at blood samples. Continuing a tradition of caring for people with Hansen's disease, but doing it with modern technology. That's what I would call a close translation. But we also have what we might call a broader translation, something like Franciscan health systems in the United States. This was their 2013 annual report. A coalition of many different hospitals that were founded by Franciscan communities that try to instill Franciscan values in their staff, in their medical care, in the way that they treat patients, the way that they address the needs of the poor and the underinsured. That, I think, can also be a legitimate interpretation of Francis's care for lepers. It's not exactly the same. But it's looking at that proportion. What's the relationship? And how could that be expressed today? It's always going to be partial, limited, historical, specific. There's not one size fits all. Let's take another one. Friars, according to the rule of 1223, shall not ride horseback. And I renew that vow every morning. Even those of you who were up very early did not see me riding around on horseback this morning, because I didn't do it, and I won't do it all day. I get up every morning, I say, I am not going to ride horseback today. And I just don't. I just put it right there. Just don't do that. The image of riding on a horse in the early 13th century conjured up a very specific class of people who had the right to ride a horse. Because it was a right. It was a legal right. Anybody couldn't just ride a horse. You needed to have the right license, we might say. It included members of the nobility, high ecclesiastical authorities like bishops and abbots, and included all members of the crusading knightly class who could afford it. The association then between horses and horseback riding was with wealth, with highly influential members of society, and with warfare. So you didn't ride horses just for fun. You know, you wouldn't go, oh, let's go out horseback riding. Oh, who are we going to kill? Oh, you know that. So it's that sort of thing. So we have a friar, God rest him, Father John Genie. I'll mention him. He's beaming down on us from heaven, who was at Mission San Javier near Tucson, Arizona, and a very hot part of the country out there in the Arizona desert. And a group of very eager Chamber of Commerce business guys, Catholics, decided that they wanted to dress up as Spanish soldiers and get on old-style Spanish horses, these kind of small ponies to us. They'd found these Spanish horses someplace. And they were going to reenact the founding of Mission San Javier with the Marcos de Niza expedition in the 16th century. And what they needed was a friar on a horse to be Friar Marcos de Niza. And Father John Genie, about 6'4", 280 sopping wet, was just the man for the job. And they got this big, old, heavy gray wool habit that the missionary friars used to wear, and a big old cross and a sombrero, big sombrero. And they had a horse for him, and they told him this great idea. Father John took one look at these guys and the horse, and they're going to ride across the desert in the cactus, in the hot weather, come over. He said, I'd love to, guys, but St. Francis said, in the rule, that we may not ride horseback. And they said, Padre, we wouldn't want you to break any of your vows for that. He said, well, that's very nice. I'd love to do it. Why don't I stand over here in the shade and kind of next to the bell tower, and when I see you come over the hill, I'll ring the bell. How's that? Oh, that'd be great, Pod. That'd be great. You know, is that really what it's about today? Is it really about horseback riding? How would we make that translation into the 21st century? What would communicate something of what the horse communicated in the 13th century? It's something that not everybody would have access to, that would be pretty expensive, that would also project a certain idea of power and authority. And you might think it might be an inappropriate means of transport for a friar to show up at the parish luncheon. You know? You just think about that, huh? But there are other forms of transportation that you might say are not exactly horseback, but you know, they don't seem to communicate something that's kind of imposing or powerful or, they look kind of silly, as a matter of fact. There are many different ways you could translate that, but what you're trying to get at is something that's a very ordinary means of transportation that doesn't necessarily imply high social status and wealth and power and authority, something that's much more approachable down to earth. Again, every interpretation is separate, specific, and limited. Let's take another one, though. 1200, it's a little bit difficult to read. It's very tiny up at the top of the screen. Let them pray for the living and the dead, in the earlier rule. And here is a prayer book, actually a gospel book, that Francis used. It's in the United States. It's in Baltimore at the Walters Art Museum in Baltimore. This, we believe, is the gospel book that Francis opened with Brother Bernard and Brother Peter when they began the first piece of the rule. They opened the gospel book three times. This is the gospel book from a church dedicated to St. Nicholas in the Diocese of Assisi from the early 13th century. We think it's from the Church of St. Nicholas in downtown Assisi. There were only two churches dedicated to St. Nicholas, and the other one was out in the bushes behind Mount Subasio. That is what prayer looked like to Francis in the 13th century. What is it going to look like to pray for the living and the dead today? Maybe some of you already know this. This is a little something called eye breviary, which helps to support the Franciscan custody of the Holy Land. And this is the priest who founded it, Father Paolo Padrini of Tortona, Italy. We're still praying for the living and the dead, but the way, the shape that it takes, the context in which that is done, is one that is in an electronic universe, the universe in which we live. It's a translation into our context of what would have been done on parchment with ink in the 13th century. Oh, back. Hello. This is the page, the first time that the Canticle of the Creatures, or the Canticle of Brother Sun, was written down, about the year 1250. Francis did not write it down. He couldn't write. He couldn't see when he composed the canticle. We don't have any evidence of people writing it down before 1250. Italian probably did not have a written form much earlier than 1250. This is considered the earliest Italian poem. If you know a little bit of Italian, what you see there, right here, beginning with the letter A, Altissimo Omnipotente Bon Signore, Tue sole laude la gloria l'onore ogni benedizione. Most High Almighty Good Lord, yours are the praises, the glory, the honor, and every blessing. And there was music, a melody composed by Francis that went with it, that goes on those four lines of the medieval musical staff. And the lazy bones friar who was supposed to write the musical notes didn't do his job. So we got the lyrics, but we didn't get the tune. Which in a sense is great, because if we had the tune, we would only sing it to that tune. All creatures of our God and King. I don't know what it would sound like. But because we don't have it, musicians have created hundreds and hundreds of musical settings, a way to celebrate the goodness of the creation that God has made. That every one of God's creatures gives praise and glory to God. That's what it looked like in the 13th century when Francis expressed it in his language. And this is his native language. This is Umbrian Italian. It looks very different in the 21st century. When written in English, this is one of my former students, Brother Keith Warner, with Sister Ilia Delio and Pamela Wood, their book on Care for Creation, A Franciscan Spirituality of the Earth, where they're trying not to repeat what Francis says in the Canticle of Brother Sun, but to try to find that relationship and express it within the context of our awareness of the world and creation in the 21st century. Again, limited, historical, partial. It's their attempt to translate. In each of these examples, what we are seeing is that we need to do a work of discernment. We have to understand our past, not in order to repeat the past, that's Franciscan fundamentalism, but rather that we start with a good understanding of the past so that we can fill in that blank at the end where we say, how do we translate that today?
In our last session of the afternoon, I'm going to speak not about individual examples of how we do this, but moving this up, you might say, moving it up a notch into the world of what is called social enterprise, the world of the social entrepreneur, how we find institutional and structural ways to interpret the Franciscan vision in ways that have a larger impact on larger groups of people. It goes beyond the individual activity to the activities of an organized, established institution that tries to do things that affect the common good. If you come back at 4:15, we'll talk about that.